This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Anne Lamott's readers first met Elizabeth and Rosie Ferguson in Lamott's novel Rosie. Rosie was a toddler then, and Elizabeth was a widow who drank too much, but the two were extremely close, sharing both a smart mouth and keen insight. In the novel Crooked Little Heart, Rosie's a teenager who finds tennis, and Elizabeth finds the affable, loving James. The third installment is called Imperfect Birds, and it's out now in paperback. In that book, Rosie's 17, and in the words of the novel, black-haired, strapping, and fabulous. She gets good grades, she still plays a mean game of tennis, but she also does every drug she can find, prescription and otherwise. While trying to support and maintain Elizabeth's recovery, Elizabeth and James must come to terms with Rosie's descent. Anne Lamott is no stranger to the harsh realities of family life in America. In 11 books, many of them bestsellers, she has taken a hard look at everything from addiction to faith, motherhood, and the death of a loved one. She's famous for her unflinching eye and irreverent sense of humor, and Anne Lamott will be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight, but first she joins me in the studio. Welcome. Good to
have
you.
Thank you.
What made you want to check in with Rosie, Elizabeth, and James again?
Well, I always knew that I would. They're probably my favorite people I've ever worked with before, and you have to want to spend about 3 years with fictional characters. And partly what was going on was that when my son became a teenager and I started talking to more teenage girls, I started finding out about a secret world of that mostly involved keeping off the radar with the parents and keeping various lies going and keeping this thing with boys going that did not seem to bode well for women's liberation. And kids were dying in Marin, where I live, this wealthy enclave in just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and they're dying of oxy. You know, the kids kind of go collectively crazy on ecstasy. I smoked what my friend Tom calls the non-habit-forming marijuana every day for about 20 years, but it's different dope than they're smoking. Yeah. They're, you know, they're really addicted. The kids are addicted. It's taken away their motivation. And at the same time, they're pressured up the yin-yang to do this exceptionalism that is the new normal to try to get into schools. You need more than into the grade schools, more than a 4.0. So I just wanted to see what would happen when that state of things descended on the Ferguson household, and if Elizabeth and James's marriage could survive that much secret and that much sorrow and that much those high stakes.
Thanks for the plug, by the way, State of Things. I appreciate that. But tell me about how you think you gained entree into what you describe as a secret world. Why were they telling you all about this stuff?
Well, partly because most of them had come through. There were five main girls that I talked to that were 19 and 20, one of whom has Hep C as a result of her partying life and having unsafe sex to get the very, very coolest guy there that night to like her for that entire night. So they had gone through this at 15 and 16. I mean, I was an alcoholic teenager. I was a total lush and a pothead, and I had, you know, it was the 60s, but I wasn't like that. I mean, they are so... Anyway, I just started talking to him, and I just started without judgment saying, tell me, why are you doing that? Why were you doing that? Well, the guys like it. Oh, really? The guys like that, you know, promiscuous, casual, serial, whatever. And I said, how did you get away with this? How did you get money for cocaine? It's expensive. How do you get so much Adderall? Do you get it online? No. Lots of the kids have it for prescriptions. The moms get it to keep their weight down. It's just right there. How do you do this? Why do you do that? What's that about? And of course, it's all human condition stuff, but as it is being lived and presented by teenagers with technological savvy and little telecommunications ports wherever they go, you know, so it's different than when I was young.
Anne Lamott is with me, and her new novel is Imperfect Birds. Will you read for us?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. This is the very first page or so, and it's called The Parkade. Elizabeth Ferguson looked around at the Saturday morning comings and goings of townspeople and saw parents who had lost or were losing their kids, kids who had lost or were losing their minds. She and James sat with their coffees and newspaper on the wide steps of the parkade, which was what everyone in town called the parking bay in the center of town, making it seem a lot more festive than it was. It was just a big parking lot that abutted the boulevard that ran from San Quentin to the east all the way out to Olema on the Pacific coast, but several feet higher than the town's original crossroads, so you had to climb upstairs to reach it and drive downhill to exit. A bean-shaped lot for 80 cars that was ringed in skinny trees and foliage, lavender rhododendrons, whose blooms wouldn't last much longer as spring faded, and geraniums. There was a bus kiosk on the north side and two weathered sets of concrete steps, the one where Elizabeth and her husband sat reading, another at the far end across from the movie theater. She and James were waiting for their daughter, whom they were going to take shopping in town, if and when she ever arrived. Rosie needed notebooks and some summer tops for her last weeks as a junior at the local high school, and shops fanned out below the parkade, stretching almost to the northern face of Mount Tamalpais. But Elizabeth was nowhere in sight. But Rosie was nowhere in sight. Elizabeth felt large and worried. Even sitting down, she was taller than her husband, and her otherwise dark, thick hair was slightly more gray-streaked. But Rosie was taller than either, almost 5'11", black-haired, strapping, and fabulous, except when they wanted to disown her, like now. Can I just add briefly that there is that parkade in the town where I lived with my son, and he lives in San Francisco now, but that place is just a magnetic beehive of teenage behavior. And over by the bus kiosk, a lot of really bad stuff goes down. And there's all these teenage boys hanging around trying to look like homeless people, but without the inconvenience, you know, and they have car keys and Starbucks. So, but this parkade, the whole, this community ringed in foliage was a pure secrets, but also of pleasure and also of destruction, really called to me.
Well, what you convey, I think, beautifully in the novel is that the sense of danger that almost anybody should see, the mm-hmm. sense of imminent destruction in this parkade, mm-hmm. but also the fact that Elizabeth and James are at once vaguely aware and yet oddly unaware. They miss a lot of cues. They miss a lot of turns along the way.
Yes, they do. I think James less than Elizabeth. But Elizabeth grew up in an alcoholic family, and really the first rule of being a child in an alcoholic family or family with mental illness or infidelity is that you agree at 4 and 5 not to see what's going on. And so you develop the habit of kind of working with these people so that the ruin of their life doesn't show. And you get, you know, you're issued a clipboard at 6 and you get a little caseload, and you just learn to help everybody keep the system intact. And so Elizabeth, to her fault, I think, really desperately wants to be friends with Rosie and is friends. And I think it takes every ounce of her will to discover at some point that kids don't need you to be a friend. It's probably the most destructive position you can take. But so she sees stuff and she smells stuff. And it says in the early pages, she sort of accidentally snooped through Rosie's journal and purse. And she knows a little bit's going on. But Rosie is exceptional. She's a 4.2 student. She's a physics genius. She's a champion and ranked tennis player. She's going to get into any college she wants to. She's funny and she can be very loving. And the other girls in the junior class, some of them are in states of true devastation. And so you think, in fact, Elizabeth and James say in a couple page later that they think they've dodged a bullet, that this is just normal experimentation. And again, Elizabeth's gift is for not seeing what's going on.
And Rosie's gift is partly the ability to deceive, a gift that she learns to loathe. She's very disappointed that she's so successful as a liar.
Yes, she is. Very disappointing. But the thing is that these kids, and my son included, but these five girls that had come through it, what's so astonishing is they could really work for the CIA. I mean, they are so on top of their game. Parents, at some point you just have to go look in the mirror and go, I'm the problem here because I'm such a loser. And these kids are much smarter than I'm going to be. And anything they need to know, they're getting from each other. They're Googling it. They're texting each other. They're wearing bags of clean urine strapped to their legs when they know that they have a urine test coming up if they're going to get sent away. You know, they can, and with a few drops of bleach, they can doctor a marijuana urinalysis test, as Rosie learns pretty early on. So, yeah.
Is there a job? Is there an industry in being the designated urinator? I don't know. It just occurred to me that that would be an industry.
Well, there are kids that I forgot what it takes, but after a week, you probably have clean urine. A week after, really, it's more like 2 weeks, but there are kids that aren't into it. They're into other things. Yeah. They might be much, much more into Oxy or they may be drunks. I certainly was. And so they can give urine, and if you're not being tested for alcohol, I mean, I don't think urine will show it so well. You would use more typically a breathalyzer, but the tests are very specific. So you can get people that are the drunks to give you some nice warm pee for your urine test.
Well, you talked about earlier the fact that, you know, you need to be honest with yourself. You really want to do the best for your kids. Look in the mirror. I'm a loser. Is it I'm a loser, or you have to be willing to break that friendship and have your kids not like you and scream and say awful things to your face?
Yeah, well, you don't look in the mirror and go, I'm a loser, because then your kid is doomed also. But you look in the mirror and you go, who's the crazy one here? Because I know my kid is smoking a lot of dope. I can tell everyone he or she loves is smoking a ton of dope. Two of them have been to rehab. One has been in a car accident. And yet I'm giving my child car keys. And yet I'm giving my child an allowance and there's no accounting. And I am noticing that 20s are missing from time to time, and I'm letting it go. Again, because I got good at letting things go when I was young. I have the habit. I don't want to make waves. Now, the other thing that's happening in Imperfect Birds is that Elizabeth has a really beautiful and profound marriage, and all of a sudden you have someone with a really big problem. Elizabeth hasn't been able to stay sober, and she's on a little run now, but she has just caused the family an enormous heartbreak when Rosie finds her a couple years earlier on the floor. And so she's just trying to be creating a house where everyone's loving each other, and not every minute. It's not like, you know, The Sound of Music, but where people are getting along and agreeable, and Rosie's thriving, and the husband, who's a writer, is doing more or less okay, and people aren't at their throats. So she eventually, and I think the pivotal plot point, keeps a secret from James that a husband should know, that involves a window. And but so you start playing this game of it, of moving parts of chess pieces around so that one person isn't mad at the other, because then you have a miserable dinner. And I think what you just said is exactly hitting the nail on the head. You have to do the terrible, terrible hard work of gripping yourself around the risk and making yourself agree not to have friendship be the priority anymore. Parenting needs to be the priority. Seeing what's going on, seeing what's true, and if you don't know, finding out what's true needs to be the priority. Kids go crazy, and they do hate you, and maybe you save their life.
Yeah, and that part, it seems to me, hasn't changed from generation to generation. But what has? What do you think is... Because you did suggest earlier that things are categorically, fundamentally different than when you were young and creating some trouble on your own.
Well, one thing paradoxically that is so different that is kind of a retro thing is I was 16 the year Ms. Magazine came out, and the women's movement literally saved me. It was my salvation, like it would be in a Jesus household. It saved me. It changed me. It gave me life. It was where my life began. It's where I got to push back my sleeves and go, oh, okay, I got it. And when you see the modern, many, many, many of the modern girls in full power mode, they're being subservient to the boys and men sexually to get high, to get a hit, to get more of the cocaine, to feel very loved and chosen and of value, because the grades aren't making them feel of value. The grades are just putting more stress on them to do better because they got an A- in one class, and it really looks bad now. You know, it doesn't look like they're going to get into where they wanted to. So they want, so it's another addiction, and that's very retro. I think the telecommunications kiosks that are our teenagers between their pockets and their purses and their cars, it's stunning. I mean, you'll notice that because this book is chronological to Rosie, which came out 25 years ago, it doesn't take place in the 2000s. So that, because if you wrote a book that took place in 2008, you know what it would be about? Cell phones. It'd be about smartphones. Right. And every other sentence would have to reference the text, the chimes, the alerts, the Google, the who, you know. And I just thought, oh, God, bore me later, because, you know, I had a teenager for enough years to kind of have had it with the teenage cell phone life. So the computers, I mean, everything is just is so revved up. It's so 24/7. I was just realizing what pulled my family together was a newspaper that we sat down at breakfast and the paper was sort of handed out. and I don't even, you know, that to me just seems like having like log fires, and, you know, I mean, just have, you know, campfires and singing Michael Row the Boat Ashore. But that's what you did. My brother, yeah. John got sports. My dad got, because he was the dad, and this was before the women's movement got the front page. My mom got Herb Cain, and you know, and that's not there anymore. That's and the thing of having dinners with kids. I mean, yeah. Even to sit down, I was with a teenager on Monday night in New York City, and she, her mother made this exquisite meal, and the girl was saying, "No, I don't want any vegetables." And I said, "What? You don't want?" She said, "Oh, I don't really enjoy vegetables." And she wanted a salad either. So you want salad, just lettuce and tomato. She said, "Well, I don't really like lettuce. I don't go for lettuce." It went on and on. And I said to the mom, I said, if I had said to my parents that I really didn't enjoy something that was put on the dish in front of me, they would have laughed so hard. Like my mother would have wet her. My mother would have gone, "Ken, make him stop, make him stop." It wasn't an option. And now too many things that I'm not sure are good options are options. Too much freedom, too much knowledge, too much intensity. Well, so I think it's a hard time to be a teenager.
Thank you for reflecting it so well in your latest novel, Anne Lamott. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Anne Lamott's newest book is out in paperback. It's called Imperfect Birds. Anne Lamott's going to be at Quail Ridge Books and Music tonight, reading from Imperfect Birds at 7:30 p.m. That's our program. Thanks for listening to The State of Things. You can find us at stateofthings.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. William Kumpf and Nasser Abbas are our interns. Robin Copley's the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.